Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast, network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you check out everything else that 1517 is doing. That would be books, articles, videos, other podcasts, events. Go get all the information for that stuff over at 1517. You can also become a supporter of everything that 1517 does. I mean, you might notice that all our stuff is free. It's free because of the generous support of people like you. So you can become a supporter by clicking the donate link on the homepage there, or go down in the show notes and find the support the show link, and you can click on that and become a supporter. Thank you so much to those of you who do that. Chad, last week, Job is dishing out an answer, you know, so Eliphaz says, I've got it figured out. The issue here is that Job's wickedness is very great. I mean, it's so great. Let me tell you how great it is. And then just manufactures some wickedness. I mean, just invents some wickedness wholesale and says, these are the things that Job does, some things we have no evidence of. In fact, we have every reason to believe that none of that stuff is true, because none of that stuff is the kind of stuff that God would boast about someone for doing, and God definitely did some boasting in Job. Job replies to Eliphaz, and it's a long reply, so we got through some of it. And Job's whole argument is, look, none of that's true. He does some more talking about God. And so his argument is kind of like, listen, your argument is that I'm so wicked that I just don't concern myself with God at all. I don't care about God. But actually, my main question is, where is God? Like, I can't find him anywhere. Like, I would love to have a conversation with him. I'd love to bring my complaint. In fact, if I could find out where God was and could go see him, I'm 100% convinced that I'll come out vindicated. I have an ironclad case here. I just need him to hear it. I don't know if someone has misinformed him. I don't know if he has me confused with someone else. But like, I'm telling you, if I could make my case, I'm going to win this argument. And that's kind of a gist of where we ended up. We ended up in 24. We got through the first 13 verses. And Job is going to continue on for a little bit here.
Yeah, he's going to talk quite a bit in this chapter about, well, he has already talked about, and then we're going to pick it up from there. Talk about how, yeah, he's wanting his day in court, but he's basically saying, hey, there's a lot of people who really should be in court because they're guilty. And here's a list of the things that they've done. So those first 12 verses of Job 24, he talks about how the poor are mistreated. You know, they're wondering about for food, their clothing's being taken away from them. They're sitting out in the rain at night. You got people who are even like snatching babies from the bosom of their mother. Just a lot of bad stuff going on, done by bad people who, at least it seems, are getting away with it. In fact, he finishes verse 12 by saying that the soul of the wounded cries out for help, and yet God charges no one with wrong. So what's up with all that? He's not done with that. He's gonna pick up with that same thread in verses 13 and following by talking about people like murderers and adulterers and thieves, basically people who, what seemed to be the common theme between these is they like to work under cover of darkness. So he's going to pick up with that group in verse 13. So I'll read 13 through 17. He said, there are those who rebel against the light, who are not acquainted with its ways and do not stay in its paths. The murderer rises before its light that he may kill the poor and needy. And in the night, he's like a thief. The eye of the adulterer also waits for the twilight, saying, no eye will see me. And he veils his face. In the dark, they dig through houses. By day, they shut themselves up. They do not know the light. For deep darkness is mourning to all of them. They are friends with the terrors of deep darkness. So, of course, light, darkness is the twin themes here. And basically all these guys, they're we got to kind of the literal and the metaphorical happening at the same time, because he's saying these guys like to work under cover of darkness, like literal darkness. So the adulterer, you know, he waits till it's dark. He sneaks out so he can go wherever he's going to meet up for his tryst. But he's not going to be seen. Darkness is going to cover him. Same with thieves who are breaking into houses or the murderer. All these guys love darkness because it hides their deeds. At the same time, with the literal, you also have the metaphorical, of course, because deeds of darkness and things done in darkness is a common biblical theme. You see it in New Testament as well, sons of light, sons of darkness, where you basically have, as it says in verse 17, deep darkness is mourning to all of them. So they've exchanged darkness for light and light for darkness. They call good evil and evil evil good. So this is kind of continuing the same thread that he used in the first 12 verses, basically saying, look at all these guys. They're doing these things. They're living in the darkness. They're using darkness as their covering. And they say, and this is from the middle of verse 15, no eye will see me. And I think they don't mean just none of my neighbors are going to figure out what's going on. I think this is kind of the same kind of practical atheism we often see in the Psalms, where you have people acting as if, living as if there is no God, as if there's not going to be any kind of judgment. God doesn't see what they're doing. They can live any way they want to, and there's not going to be any kind of divine punishment that results from their deeds.
Yeah, Job seems frustrated that it seems to be working, right? He's like, not only did he
Oh,
do
yeah.
these things, but this like under the cover of night thing, that shouldn't work, but it seems like it is.
Yeah, it seems to be fairly profitable for them
Yeah.
because they're continuing this, or they're getting away with what they're doing. Even though, and this is implicit in all of this, even though Job would be suggesting, I'm not an adulterer, I'm not a murderer, I'm not a thief, I haven't made darkness into light, and yet look what's happening to me. I mean, you don't see a murderer who's lost all of his family and his health and sitting on an ash heap scraping sores. But this is where I'm at.
Yeah, well,
So,
it seems like he there's a there, this argument too is that like how frustrating is it? Because obviously a part of this is like rebuffing again like some of their arguments are like, well, you know, Job, if you weren't wicked, this wouldn't be happening. Obviously, Job is doing this. Hey, so there's these people doing this stuff at nighttime under the cover of darkness. They're like the children of darkness, and you know it. I know it. Why doesn't the Lord know it? Like surely he like what do you what is your what's your theological argument against this? Like you know this is happening, I know this is happening. What do we assume that the Lord doesn't know this is happening? Like surely if we know it, he knows it.
yeah.
And yet I'm the one over here on an ash heap scraping boils with pottery. Like my house is completely destroyed, all my children are dead. Like what is that? Explain that one.
Yeah, how does this fit into your theological system? Yeah, the thieves, the adulterers, the murderers, they say, no eye will see me. And Job's like, well, you can understand why they would say that, because they're getting away scot-free with all of these kinds of secret undercover of darkness activities. Yeah, I mean, who wouldn't be frustrated with this, right? I mean, we simply read this and it's frustrating.
Well,
So
you might,
imagine Job living through it.
it'd be like, it's one thing if it's happening and you just like, are like, well, you know, it's happening. It's like a whole nother level of frustration if somebody comes to you and makes the sorts of arguments that his friends have made. And then you have to be like, okay, like, you know, it's annoying. You know how you don't go out at night in certain places because like, you know, something bad is probably going to happen to you because that's like, where's people up to no good doing no good things. Okay. That's annoying, but what's really, really annoying is when you're telling me that like no bad deed goes unpunished, while we know that's going like that we know that this is going on, and now you're pretending like you don't know.
Yeah, they're ignoring reality. Everybody knows this happens, and they're saying the opposite. This is more their ivory tower theologizing, where none of their words actually match reality, and yet they would rather stick with their self-deceptions than acknowledge the truth and try and deal with it theologically. Okay, bad stuff does happen to good people, and good things happen to bad people. So how are we going to explain this? How are we going to grapple with this? They just refuse to even go there because it doesn't match their preconceived notions of the way that God should operate in this world. I think, for them, there is no mystery with God.
Yeah.
They've got God figured out. They know that he's a tit for tat kind of God. You do good, he does good to you. You do bad, he does bad to you. That is the extent of their understanding of the way God works in this world with humanity. And they just simply won't even consider the possibility that there's more to it, that there's a mystery here, that there's more to learn.
Well, and I think that you said this a couple episodes back. I think this is like the crux of it, is that there is no category in their mind for an innocent sufferer. Like it doesn't fit at all. A square peg in a round hole of in their theology. Like, this does not fit.
Mm-hmm. And then you take that and you run with that to the Gospels, and you can see exactly why the cross of Christ makes no sense to people who are trapped in this kind of theologizing. And this was very much kind of the Pharisees' way of thinking about things. And probably not even just the Pharisees, because Jesus' own disciples, when they saw the blind man, right?
Oh, yeah.
Said, I mean, it wasn't like some Pharisees walked up to Jesus and said, "Hey, Jesus, see that blind guy? Who sinned, him or his parents?" No, these were Jesus' own disciples that said this. "Hey, that guy's blind. Who messed up?"
Yeah. Right?
Did he do something? Did his parents do something? Because obviously, he can't simply be enduring something that is not the cause of sin. So even for them, you know, the category of innocent sufferer, or someone just suffering because we're living in a fallen world, were categories that they just couldn't deal with.
Well, I mean, and then Jesus has to go to like an event example, right? And say like, "Hey, remember that tower fell on all those people?"
Yes.
And like, you were like, "Man, I wonder what they did." Well, let me tell you, like, they didn't do anything you're not doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So repent.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. So that whole talk of darkness and light and thieves and murderers and whatnot, that takes us through 17. Now, verse 18 introduces a bit of an enigma. And I've run into several different theories behind it's 18 through the rest of this chapter. So verse 18 through verse 24 or 25. You can probably pull five Job commentaries off the shelf and come away with at least three different opinions, if not five different opinions, as to what's going on here. The basic issue or problem is that what is said in verses 18 through the rest of the chapter does not sound like words you would expect coming from Job. In fact, it sounds exactly like something that his friends would say. So there's various theories that are put forward here. Those who, like me, and I agree with those who say this doesn't sound like Job at all, say either that Job is quoting his friends. In fact, that's the way that the ESV has couched this entire discussion. So if you look at the ESV, verse 18 begins with, "You say," so Job is speaking, but he says, "You say, swift are they on the face of the waters," etc. But if you look in the Hebrew, there is no "you say." It just begins with, "Swift are they on the face of the waters." So the ESV has inserted, even though they really don't tell us, they've inserted "you say" into their translation because they understand this to be Job quoting the words of his friends. So that's one possibility of explaining the overall friends-like theme of these verses. Others suggest that actually verses 18 through 25 are the words of Zophar, except somewhere along the way in the process of textual transmission, the opening phrase "and Zophar said" has been omitted. And the reason they say it Zophar is because we have three speeches by Eliphaz. We have three speeches by Bildad. We have two speeches by Zophar. So some people think this was actually his words, and somehow they got shifted around in the text, and the introduction of Zophar's speech was left out. However you want to frame this, as Zophar's missing speech or as Job quoting his friends, I think either one of those, it's pretty obvious when we begin to read through these that we're not dealing here with something that matches what Job has been saying all along, but it certainly does match what his friends have been insisting upon, especially the theme, general theme is upon the short-lived nature of the wicked, or the short-lived nature of the success of the wicked, that it's not going to last very long before they fall on their faces and are facing judgment. So just a bit of background there as to, if you look at your translations, you're going to see various kinds of ways of rendering this. I do actually think the ESV has done it right by inserting "you say" at the beginning of verse 18 as a way of alerting us to the fact that Job is probably then quoting his friends, or not, maybe if not quoting, then summarizing the gist of the argument that they have made. So anyway, that's a bit of an introduction to what's coming up.
Well, it'd be hard to believe that a couple of things wouldn't happen. I mean, one, in this conversation, it'd be hard to imagine that no one would interrupt anyone else. So maybe you have that.
Yes.
It'd also be unlikely that you might not bring up something that somebody else had said, right? Where you'd say like, "Hey, you said this. Let me respond to that point." So I mean, yeah. It makes total sense that this would happen. It doesn't seem out of place.
Yeah, I mean, we still argue this way, legitimately or illegitimately today. I mean, if we're having a debate, argument, discussion, whatever, with somebody else with whom we disagree, we'll often say something like, "So what you're saying is blah, blah, blah." And maybe that's a fair assessment of what they say, or maybe it's an unfair assessment of what they say, but we often do restate the argument of the person that we're having a discussion with, as a way of perhaps bringing some clarity, or perhaps in sarcasm. There's all different ways, all different reasons
Yeah,
we do this, but
I do this all the time when I'm arguing. I'm taking notes in my mind to use against you later, and so it's a very common thing for me to say in an argument is, earlier you said, and then I will say what you said, and I'll be like, and now you've contradicted that, or that's not true because whatever it is. So I think that's a pretty common thing to do.
Yeah. Or you'll restate their argument, but take it to its logical and often ridiculous
Yes.
conclusion.
So what you're
So if,
really saying is.
yeah, right. So if what you've said this, well, if that's true, then it follows that this and this and this and this are true, and you kind of take it to its,
My wife loves it
absurd
when I do that.
conclusion. I'm sure. Yeah, it's probably a
It's her favorite.
very favorite
I'm
conversations
sure
to
your wife
have.
loves it when these words come out of your mouth. So what you're really saying is, I'm sure she loves that.
Yeah, I do know that every time someone on social media says that in response to something that I've written, I mean, and I'm talking about 99% certainty here that what they're saying I'm saying is not what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think this is true. Anytime someone has done that to me, where they're like, "So what you're saying is, 99.9% of the time, I disagree with whatever the next thing out of their mouth is."
Yeah. Oh yes, it is. It's very hard to be objective and to state with great honesty what our opponent is saying. So anyhow, all that introduction here to 18 and the following. So Job speaks and he says to his friends, "You say, swift are they on the face of the waters. Their portion is cursed in the land. No treader turns toward their vineyards. Drought and heat snatch away the snow waters. So does Sheol, those who have sinned. The womb forgets them. The worm finds them sweet. They are no longer remembered. So wickedness is broken like a tree." Don't you just love the way the Bible is like unafraid of taking about 10 metaphors and just shuffling them all together? When we're in high school, we learn, "I don't mix metaphors." And then you read the Bible and you're like, I think that's all they do is mix metaphors together. So we got all kinds of images here. We got water things going on. We got agricultural things going on. We got water stuff. We got weather stuff, womb, worms, everything. And that's in three verses. The basic message, of course, is that is the brevity of the and the of the life and of the any kind of success of the wicked. So They're kind of like, I think this opening line, swift are they in the face of the waters. It's kind of like the image of foam that's on the surface of the waters. You know, it's there for a second, then it's blown away. And then he shifts to the agricultural image. Their portion is cursed in the land. No treader turns toward their vineyards. What does that mean? Well, it means that a treader is one who's going to tread on the grapes to crush them, of course, to begin the process of making wine. Well, no treader turns toward their vineyards because their vineyards are unfruitful. They don't have any grapes to tread, so there's no work for him to do there. So they're experiencing the loss of their harvest. And then you have drought and heat snatching away the snow waters. So I mean, I just got off the phone with my mom this morning, and they live up in the Texas Panhandle. They got like, I don't know, 8 or 9 inches of snow, which is awesome.
Me too.
Oh, you did too. Yeah. So
Yeah.
my brother-in-law Scott is a farmer and a rancher. And so when you get snow in the winter, it's awesome because the snow, of course, is going to melt slowly and it's going to saturate the ground. It's great for your crops. So snow's great for people who are involved in any kind of farming or ranching. But in this case, you have the snow waters being snatched away by drought and heat. So it doesn't do any good. You can get all the snow you want, but if you have drought and heat, then it's not going to do the ground any good. It's gonna evaporate. And he says that's the way it works with those who have sinned. Sheol is going to be the drought and heat that snatches them away. And of course, the implication is this happens fast. You know, sure, you might enjoy your sinning for a while, but it's not going to last. Sheol is going to reach up from the grave with a claw and grab your ankle and yank you down into Sheol. And then the womb forgets them, I guess, meaning that you know, this place where they spent so much time is going to be forgetting them because they are no more. Now there's no doubt about what this line means. The worm finds them sweet.
Oh man.
Okay, I think I have to explain that one. Worm is happy to find them in its lunchbox. They are no longer remembered. So wickedness is broken like a tree. So this is Job, of course, just summarizing the basic argument that his friends have made in lots of different ways, that the righteous will live long, the righteous will be blessed, but the wicked will not. They will be short, and they are cursed. And then he picks up with verse 21, again, kind of quoting more of what his friends are saying. They, that is the wicked, what do? Well, they wrong the barren, childless woman. They do no good to the widow, to emblems of people who are suffering different things. One childless, one husbandless, one doesn't have children, one doesn't have a husband. They do wrong to those people. Yet, God prolongs the life of the mighty by his power. They rise up when they despair of life. He gives them security and they are supported, and his eyes are upon their ways. So God lets them go on for a little while. They are exalted for a little while, as he says in verse 24. And then, so maybe they have a little bit of life and, you know, maybe they despair, but they rise up, they get a little security, they're supported, and God's watching them. His eyes are on their ways. And after he's exalted them just a little while, then bam, they're gone. They're brought low. They're gathered up like all the others. They're cut off like the heads of grain. And then he wraps up this chapter. If it is not so, who will prove me a liar and show that there is nothing in what I say? So a challenge laid down there. If it's not the case, then prove me wrong.
Yeah, so you have to wonder, like, this is where like who you think is talking, or if you think Job is quoting someone else, like, just gets a little weird, right? So I'll throw out a proposition here. So if Job is quoting somebody, Zophar, whoever, and he's saying, "All right, you said this stuff," okay, because it kind of sounds like, so Job has been talking a while about, what are you talking about, man? There's like wicked people all over the place, prospering like crazy. What are you even saying to me right now? Like, this is insane. This argument, it makes no sense. And it sounds like this is like maybe a response to that argument, like, no. Oh, they're going to get cut down. They might get exalted for a little while, but it's going to happen. Like, you just wait. You just wait. And Job, of course, his argument is like, well, if they lived like ripe old ages when everybody else, like, yeah, I mean, yeah, everybody dies. Like, of course. How is that punishment? Like, exactly. Like, so they get to live the same way that everyone else lives. And then, you know, at the end, though, worm food. Well, that's everybody. So what's the difference? And so he gets to this end here and he says, if it is not so, who will prove me a liar and show me that there is nothing in what I say? I think you can take this as Job saying, you said this, and I just did prove you a liar and prove that there's nothing mm-hmm. in what you say by the argument I just made.
Yeah.
Is that how you take that?
That is how I take that. Yeah. I think it makes the most sense to assume that Job begins verse 18 by referencing the words of, yeah, so far, or whoever, whichever one of the friends. And then when you get to the very end of verse 25, it's like Job is no longer quoting them, but he's kind of summing up his argument.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes, yeah. So I proved you wrong. So show me where I'm a liar. Show me where my argument has failed, because I've definitely shown where your argument has failed. Yeah. That's the way that I read this closing section of 24.
Yeah, me too.
It's been a long response by Job. You know, some of his own words, and some quoting the words of his friends, and then demonstrating the falsehood of their arguments. And so now we come to the end of 24, and we
Bildad's going to give it a shot.
Here. Yeah, Bildad's going to give it. Yeah. Is going to give it a shot, but it's pretty short shot. So chapter 25 is only 6 verses. Bildad's response is definitely the shortest response of any of his friends. And you kind of get the impression anyway, that it's kind of like the argument is losing steam. Like they've said a lot, they've had a lot to say, but at least Job's not done by any means. But it's like his friends are out of words. They're out of anything to say. They've said all they really have to say. And as we've noted multiple times, there's not a whole lot to their argument. In fact, you can summarize their argument with a basic syllogism. You know, if you sin, if you're suffering, it's because you're a sinner. Job is suffering, and therefore Job is a sinner who deserves this kind of suffering. That's been their basic argument all through these chapters in different sorts of ways. And of course, you know, they start out by kind of speaking kindly about him, but then shifting to his current circumstances. And there have been times when they've said, hey, if you'll only get right with God, then your end is going to be even better than your beginning. So they have offered hope to him if he repents. But most of their words have been nothing more than either explicit or implicit accusations against him, that he's got some secret sin for which God is punishing him. And you can only keep repeating that so long before you finally run out of words. And I think that's kind of where they're at.
Well, I mean, so chapter 25, Bildad's going to give this, you know, I mean, it's really 5 verse response.
Right. Yeah.
And he says something, like, I'm surprised that chapter 26 isn't like one word, like where Job's like, where it just says, and Job replied, what? Like, because when I read Bildad's response to this, I'm like, what? Like, not that anything, I don't even know if Bildad says anything that's untrue in his next part. Like, everything he says is like, yeah, like, but it has nothing to do with anything that's as maybe you've got some insight here, but you're like, I think you're right that they've run out of words. So he like says some stuff about God that my reply would be like, okay. And like, I don't, what are we talking about here? Like what does that have to do with anything? Like, it'd be like, if this response could basically be like, well, you know, God is different than us. You're like, okay. Like, I don't, what? Like, you know, you're not God. What? It's very strange to me. This response. I don't think it's also like, one it of feels these disconnected.
Also, one of these arguments where, say, there's 4 or 5 of you, or 4 to relate it here to Job. This say there's four individuals sitting around, and three, it's three against one. Well, maybe one of the guys says something early in the argument that you're listening. You're like, oh, that's a pretty good line. I'm gonna use that in a few minutes. And so Bill, because Bildad basically doesn't say anything here other than what Eliphaz has already said. It's like it's one of these, yeah, and what Eliphaz said earlier, that's right. And then he repeats it. So he just doesn't have anything to offer here. Let me just read. We'll read the five verses here. You can. We'll let our listeners draw their own conclusions. Dominion. This is Bildad, the Shuhite. Dominion and fear are with God. He makes peace in the high heavens. Is there any number to his armies? Upon whom does his light not arise? How then can man be right, be in the right before God? How can he who is born of woman be pure? Behold, even the moon is not bright, and the stars are not pure in his eyes. How much less man, who is a maggot? This, sorry, it just cracks me. This man who's a maggot. Oh, and the son of man who's a worm. So, yeah. That's it. That's Bildad's argument right there. He starts out by the basic gist of his argument is that, yeah, God is very unlike us. He's way up in the heavens. He's great. He's powerful. He's omniscient. He's all these things. He's all the omnis, right? So if he's that, then psh, who are we? You know, compared to God, we're this maggot, this worm. That's it. And the only part of the argument, really, that even resembles an argument against Job is verse 4. How then can man be in the right before God? How can he who is born of a woman be pure? And of course, the implication of that is, Job, you're not in the right before God. There's no way that you are pure before God. Evidently, you have embraced impurity. Evidently, you've embraced wrong. And because of that, then this all-powerful God is punishing you with what you are with what you are receiving.
Yeah,
That's
well, it's weird because
his
Job's
argument.
argument isn't that like I'm perfect. I mean, like his whole argument is like everything being equal, why is this happening to me? Like I'm not like there's people that are out there doing crazy stuff and this isn't happening to them. Like I'm not sitting here telling you that like I've never sinned. We've heard that from Job himself. Like this is not like it's almost like you just go through this. And it's like dominion and fear are with God. He makes peace in the heavens. Right. Is there any number to his armies? No. Upon whom does his light not arise? No one. How then can a man be right before God? How can he who is born of a woman be pure? They can't. Even the moon is not bright and the stars are not pure in his eyes. Correct. How much less a man is who is a maggot and the son of man who is a worm? Sure. But I don't like what does this have to do with like that doesn't explain any like because yeah, sure, like how can a man be right before God? Like, any man. But I mean, they can't. But that still doesn't understand why I'm being singled out. It doesn't explain this.
Yeah, because he's already proven that the universe does not operate according to predictable laws of cause and effect. Because if it did, all these wicked people would be obliterated, right? So Job has demonstrated this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this a string of kind of flat platitudes is all that this amounts to. It's
Yeah.
not an argument. It's just a string of relative truisms which don't contribute anything to the discussion. And by the way, so that's it. As far as like the three friends, they're done. I mean, there are no more arguments coming from them. So Eliphaz has had his speech, and Bildad now finishes his speech, and Zophar has nothing more to say. Now we are going to meet another guy. We have a surprise, right? A surprise coming here in a few more chapters. Some guy we haven't heard of before. But these three friends, that's it. So their speech peters out on calling people maggots and worms. And that's it. So
yeah, now Job's gonna, you got like a 5-verse response, and then Job's gonna give you like a 6-chapter. He's just gonna go on.
Yeah, now that they're quiet, Job has a lot that he's going to say. And it starts out with some sarcasm. We have seen Job's sarcasm plenty of times. So you got to give the guy credit. He may have been suffering a lot, but he still had some rhetorical energy behind him.
That's why I think that he took this chapter 25 exactly the way I'm saying it. He's like, uh-huh. Like, and then answers it initially with sarcasm. Like, oh, all right, guy.
So we have 3 no's: no power, no strength, no wisdom. Here's how he starts out. This is the first 2 verses of his response. How you have helped him who has no power. How you have saved the arm that has no strength. How you have counseled him who has no wisdom, and plentifully declared sound knowledge. Just, yeah, this is... This, all the yous, these yous, by the way, are in the Hebrew, they are singular. So he's not, even though, of course, he is in a way addressing all 3 friends, he's specifically seems to be responding to Bildad, who has just given us this list of platitudes. Oh, Bildad, wow. You know, you really helped me, the one with no power. You saved me, the one without any strength, and man, what, I don't know what I would do if you hadn't been here to counsel me, because I have no wisdom of my own, but here you are counseling me and giving me this sound knowledge, fixing all of my theological problems with your 5-verse response.
Yeah, I mean, this is like saying, man, Bildad, now that you put it that way, I mean, I feel saved and wise.
Yeah. Strong. Yeah, thankfully you are in my life to give me what I needed. So that's the opening sarcastic rebuttal on the part of Job. And you know, he does have one more thing to say. I guess it's really the first 4 verses. His sarcasm is going to continue into the next verse, where he says, and I'm adding the tell me Bildad, but tell me Bildad, with whose help have you uttered words? And whose breath has come out from you? It's almost like, I mean, obviously, you must be inspired. That can't be your own breath that's exiting your mouth. This must be the words of the Spirit that have inspired you to say this sound knowledge, this wisdom that is coming out of your mouth.
Yeah, man, you sound like an angel. I mean, I just can't get over how good that was.
Yeah. So that's his opening opening response, opening rhetorical volley against Bildad. Now he's gonna kind of shift the tone a bit. So there's some things in here which are similar to the Genesis account, many which were different. But we'll get into that next week. We're gonna have him talk about how you have Sheol and Abaddon. He's gonna talk about the earth hanging on nothing, which is a pretty cool image for the Bible to use. So a lot of creation kind of things coming up here, and we'll unpack all of that when we pick up the conversation this coming episode.
All right. Well, that is it. We will find out. We're going to hear a lot from Job in the coming weeks. We have weeks of words out of Job's mouth coming up. So hopefully you will stick around for that. Chad, I will see you next week.
All right. See you then.